Anissa, if you can start by giving us a little background on yourself. You're not here in West Michigan at this moment, but your history certainly is. Tell us about your growing up years, your career as a journalist, and how you came to be a writer, both journalist and creative writer.
Sure. I was born in St. Joe, and then my family moved to Muskegon when I was about nine. So I have, you know, I spent all of my childhood and growing up in Western Michigan. Went to WMU. I'm a proud Bronco. And from there, I went to graduate school in New York City. Growing up, I was a kid who I loved reading. I loved writing stories, but I also enjoyed journalism and watching the evening news, believe it or not. So growing up, I always kind of knew I was either going to be a journalist or a novelist. As it happened, after graduate school, I found out that I actually needed real money to live.
Yeah.
So that took me in. That took me in the direction of journalism, which I absolutely love. But a few years ago, I got a little bit burned out in my career. Mm. And I sort of took a step back and I remembered, you know, look, you wanted to be a novelist for a long time. So now is probably a good time to go back to that and see if you can really do it. So I sat down and I wrote my first novel. It wasn't very good, but I kept going. So if there are any aspiring novelists out there, you know, don't give up. I kept going. And I started writing Care and Feeding. And even that did not go particularly well. But again, I kept at it. A lot of writing, as they say, is rewriting. And that's true. And the book really eventually came together. And here we are. So that's sort of a brief history of my trajectory.
You know, before we delve deeper into the writing of this novel, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about that journalism career, because you've had some wonderful achievements and you've worked at, what, CNN, Reuters?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some Emmys and, you know, you get to brag a little bit.
Yeah, I went to graduate school in New York City. And so my first job out of college was at Reuters News Service, where I was the financial news reporter. But then I got an offer to go to CNN, and I was a writer. And I wrote on and edited, actually, on some of our bigger stories, the Oklahoma, the Atlanta, the bombing at the park in Atlanta, 9/11. And for a company like CNN, it's large. You sort of share those awards with sort of the teams who work on it.
Yeah.
So I certainly can't take credit for everything, but I was part of those teams.
But you burned out. Are you still working as a journalist?
I am still working as a journalist. I'm in a new position, which I love. So I happen to be able to do, and I sort of can't believe I'm able to do, the two things I love immensely, and that is journalism as well as being a novelist.
Did writing a novel help to alleviate some of that burnout? Does one career feed the other, or are they completely separate for you?
They're both separate and connected. They're connected in that, you know, I'm using some of the same skill set, you know, the research skills, sort of discipline, an attention to deadline, and an understanding of storytelling and structure. So they're connected in that way, but they're disconnected in that as a journalist, you're writing about real events. You're writing about the lives of other people.
You mean it's not fake news, Anissa? I'm sorry. couldn't help myself.
Contrary to what you may hear, we work with actual facts. So factual parameters means you're sort of in many ways, you know, painting within the line. Certainly there's a degree of creativity within those lines, but you're creating within you're coloring within the lines as a novelist.
Yeah, as a novelist, you've got all kinds of freedom.
Yeah, there are no lines. I mean, you have the whole canvas.
Yeah.
And additionally, you're able to draw from some of your own experiences in a way that you can't do as a journalist.
Well, speaking of drawing from your own experiences, we're talking about the care and feeding of ravenously hungry girls. And I understand that when you first started on this, it was very much a focus on eating disorders, something mm-hmm. that you've been honest about, that you've gone through yourself. Mm-hmm. Talk about how the book evolved.
Yeah, when I first sat down to write Karen Feeding, I was primarily interested in writing about just one of the characters, and that's the middle sister, Viola. Mm-hmm. And looking at it from the perspective of her having an eating disorder and working in an eating disorder clinic. And a lot of that was drawn from my own personal experience of having been through treatment and sort of understanding that world. But as I was writing, it felt just sort of too insular and just and a bit too dark and just too narrow and focused. So what I did was I just sort of took a step back. And for me, and probably for every, I can't speak for every novelist, but certainly for me, each one of my characters, they have a biography, a backstory. Mm-hmm. And in Viola's backstory, there were these two sisters. And what I ended up doing was sort of looking at their lives. And as I sort of delved more deeply into their lives, I had no intention of really writing about them in any significant ways. But as I delved more deeply into their lives, I found that they had their own stories to tell. So that's how Karen Feeding sort of evolved from the story of just one woman, which is present in the novel, into the story of her two sisters as well, and it became a multiple narrator story.
Dealing with the sister, the Viola character, when eating disorders, was that cathartic for you to write about that?
Yes, it was. Just sort of in that sort of personal way to be able to explore some of the things you know and understand about yourself, but also, but in sort of the context of fiction.
Yeah.
But it was also, for me, I'm, you know, generally a private person. I never really expected to have to talk about it ultimately. I mean, for instance, my parents didn't know that I had an eating disorder. I didn't get treatment until I was about.
People can be very secretive about such things. Yeah.
Yeah, tend to be, you know, in any issues of addiction and that. But I was about 40 when I got, you know, proper treatment. And so when the book came out, I had to have a conversation with my family about it and let them know. So it was also cathartic in that sort of emotional way, but also important for me to learn how to talk about it openly.
And I love that you blew up some stereotypes about eating disorders, because I think we think of it almost as a white privilege, you know, young girls, teenagers, and you've completely turned that around and that we see that it's not just one group of people. It's a lot of different kinds of people who deal with this sort of thing.
It is, absolutely. Because there, you know, when it comes to eating disorders, there are really sort of, you know, issues of race. It, as you said, it's usually seen as a disease that affects white women. But there's also an issue of class. It's expensive to get treatment. I grew up in a white working class neighborhood. So a lot of the girls I grew up with, you know, even though they're white, their families may not have been able to afford that type of treatment. So there are questions about race. There are questions about class. There are also questions about gender. One of the interesting things about being out and about talking to people, which I, you know, truly enjoy, is how many people have talked to me about their son. So that was or brothers. So that was, you know, just interesting to me as well.
But your characters all have some kind of hunger, metaphorically, that they're dealing with, some kind of hollowness inside of them. And maybe we should back up a little bit and have you give us a little synopsis here of the novel and the characters. You know, Althea steals, Lillian is unfaithful, and of course, Viola has the bulimia. But give us a little nutshell synopsis.
Sure. So the story is about what happens to a family after the eldest sister and de facto matriarch, Althea, is sentenced to prison along with her husband. This isn't a spoiler. You know, they committed the crime, and they're on their way to prison. They have two teenage daughters, and Althea's two younger sisters are forced to come home to help care for those daughters and deal with the fallout in the community, because Althea and her husband, Proctor, are important members of the community. So while they are there, you know, dealing with this family trauma, they're also forced to confront and relive some personal trauma themselves. So what you see is this family struggling to deal with this immediate problem and also their family history in ways that can be unhealthy, but I think ultimately helpful and cathartic.
I like, too, that by bringing in these other characters in the family, whereas you had started with one but then decided to bring in the whole family, there's a very realistic aspect in that each character brings a very different perspective on looking at the rest of the family, looking at events and how they remember things, how they perceive things. When I've talked to my sister about, oh, remember this in our childhood, and we have completely different memories.
I am one of five kids. I have three sisters and one brother. And you are absolutely right. We all have bring our own perspectives and the way we sort of process those experiences that speaks to how we remember them as adults. And I was really interested in exploring that aspect of growing up, you know, side by side with someone and going through some of the same things, but having experienced them and come to remember them so differently.
And then you have an abusive father that is contrasted by a husband who, although he ends up in prison too, very protective of Althea, the character of Althea. How do you handle the topic of abuse in a family?
Yeah, one of the sort of key issues in this book is trauma, generational trauma,
yeah,
sort of handed down from one generation to the next. So you have Althea, who came out of this abusive relationship, and she is in a moment now, this whole family is in a moment now, where they have an opportunity to sort of continue visiting trauma on the people they love, or take a step back and explore that history and do something different. One of the things in writing this book is that, you know, the ending is not sort of neatly tied up in a bow. I typically tell people it's not necessarily a happy ending, but it's a hopeful one.
Yeah.
And that's what I was interested in exploring with these folks. How do you break that cycle of that generational trauma?
And what are you working on now, Ines? Now that you've broken into that world, circled back to a youthful dream of being a creative writer, is there something else now that's taking shape?
There is something else now. Yeah, I'm working on a second novel. It's also a family story, but it's a smaller family, and it takes a look at what happens after a dad goes to work one day and doesn't come home. And it explores, you know, sort of the unraveling of the secrets, you know, in that couple's marriage and sort of in their individual lives, and how that just the fallout from that can be devastating.
Well, that sounds intriguing. Looking forward to that. Well, thank you so much, Anissa, for taking time to talk with us. Before I let you go, I always like to ask, is there something you wanted me to ask and I didn't that you want to talk about?
I think we've pretty much covered things here.
Okay.
I just appreciate you having me, and it's just been a pleasure talking to you.